started to bleed. Mama, I just couldn't stand up there and do nothing. So me took one in him eye and he started to cry.
You're listening there in the background to the sound of LKJ, Linton Kwesi Johnson. The song is entitled Sonny's Letter from his CD of a long time ago, which is entitled Forces of Victory. Walter Turney, regular host for Africa Today. Thank you for joining Africa Today. Over the last more than almost a decade now, Dr. Gerald Horn has written several books that have focused to a large degree on the early years of the American Republic. The 2013 publication of Negro Comrades of the Crown highlighted African-American interest during the time of the American Revolution. Followed shortly thereafter, 2014, the Counter-Revolution of 1776, slave resistance and the origins of the United States of America. The next is The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in the 17th Century. And the most recent book from Dr. Gerald Horn is entitled The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. It's on Monthly Review Press, coming out very, very shortly. Dr. Horn is the John Jay and Rebecca Moore Chair of History and American Studies at the University of Houston. His research addresses issues of race, internationalism, politics, civil rights, and the global connections between developments in Asia, Africa, the United States, and Europe. He is the author of more than 30 books and 100 scholarly articles. And that bio was a while back, and I'm sure there's another couple of books to add on that and some more articles, and certainly is well heard and well spoken on many media channels across the world. Dr. Horn, how have you been?
Oh, fine. And yourself?
I've been very well. What are you working on now? The most recent book, which has come out, The Dawning of the Apocalypse. What are you? You always have some things in the hopper. What other ways are you going, Dr. Horn?
Well, The Dawning of the Apocalypse dropped on Wednesday, a few days ago. I just submitted today, in fact, my next book, which is The Bittersweet Science: Racism, Racketeering, and the Political Economy of Boxing.
Okay. You were talking about that last time we spoke, right?
Yeah, boxing. And then, I actually have to confess, the pandemic has slowed me down a bit, so I'm not sure what's coming out next.
Okay, you know, I was looking at an article in preparation for the talk, and I think it was perhaps Robin Kelly talking about Cedric Robinson, and he was referring to this, what he refers to as a black radical tradition, talking about racial capitalism. What is this, from your vantage point, what is this present moment? We want to talk about this, and then we'll come to the book, and then we want to go back to something about internationalism. What is this present moment for African-Americans, your long, short view of it, Gerald?
Well, I think that with reference to the recent killings in Atlanta and Minneapolis, it represents many things. But one thing it does represent, which has not received sufficient ventilation, is an unresolved class question. What I mean is that even people who consider themselves to be class warriors and even class conscious, they don't see the relationship between slaveholders and enslaved Africans as a class question, although it's probably the most intense and profound class question. And when slavery ended, quote unquote, in the 1860s, the slave masters were not compensated, unlike in Jamaica, Trinidad, Barbados, et cetera, in the 1830s, which helps to generate substantial fury against the newly freed Africans, fury that manifests itself in the Ku Klux Klan and fury that manifests itself today in terms of these vigilantes, such as in Brunswick, Georgia, or the police in, for example, Minneapolis. And then it's unresolved in the sense that we really haven't had a sufficient discourse akin to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of South Africa with regard to the fact that in many ways, Africans and descendants of the enslaved are still treated as if we're automatically criminals in waiting and disruptors of society. That is to say, as those books you cited that I wrote some years ago tended to suggest, the Africans did not stand with their slave masters in 1776 when real estate speculator George Washington revolted with his comrades against British rule in order to establish a slaveholders' republic. In other words, our ancestors did not engage in class collaboration. Class collaboration, in many ways, is the ethos of settler colonialism. It's the ethos of European settlers who crossed the Atlantic, oftentimes sponsored by investors of wealth, and then come here to dispossess the Native Americans, and if they're lucky, have control over the bodies of enslaved Africans. And because we did not support the overthrow of British rule in order to establish a slaveholders' republic, that meant that we were viewed suspiciously. And in fact, we had been collaborating with the antagonists of the slaveholders going back to 1565, when the Africans were brought to St. Augustine, Florida by the Spanish. And then we were working with the English against the Spanish. And then after the English moved into what they call Virginia in the 1600s, we started working with the Spanish against the English. And then after the Yankees overthrew the British in 1776, we started working with the British against the Yankees. And so on and so on. I could take it up to the 20th century with the black nationalists collaborating with Tokyo during World War II against the United States of America. Or the Marxist forces working with the Soviet Union against Washington. So this is one of the reasons why we're treated suspiciously, why we're treated like disruptors, criminals in waiting, which eventuates in these tragic killings that you are seeing repetitively.
Mm-hmm. Is there enough canon fodder? Is there enough consciousness? You raised earlier on the notion of truth and reconciliation, i.e. what happened in South Africa, Sierra Leone, or to some degree in Rwanda, or even the peace agreements that are a little bit shaky coming out of Colombia. Is that something that's even fathomable in contemporary U.S. politics, truth and reconciliation?
Well, fathomable. I think so, because right now things are moving very rapidly. Things are moving very quickly. It shows you how when the cork comes out of the bottle, matters that were not considered just weeks ago seem inevitable today. And so likewise, I would not rule out the possibility of truth and reconciliation. Hopefully we'll do it better than was done in South Africa. I hope we'll do it better than was done in Sierra Leone. And it's going to be a struggle, though, because I think it would be a mistake to assume that the Oval Office is on the run. His popularity ratings are still in the 40s. He still has a maniacally passionate base rooted in the Euro-American middle class and working class. And that has deep historical roots. It's the latest example of the class collaboration that I was referring to a moment ago. It will not be overturned easily. But the good news is the international protests. I just read, and Fox News is playing this up, which should give you a hint, that Burkina Faso, the West African nation, on behalf of the African Union, is launching a debate in the United Nations Human Rights Council with regard to the issue of systemic, their term, racism towards black Americans. This is significant. This is profound. This is new. And I would also say that I doubt if Ouagadougou would have moved in that direction without an okay, I'm afraid to say, from the neocolonial patron in France. And so in some ways, it also represents the growing rift between and amongst so-called allies. And a personal note, I've been doing a lot of German television, believe it or not, lately. And one of the things the commentator, the interrogator, was pressing me on Deutsche Welle, was he wanted me to agree with him that those defined as white in the United States of America should have collective guilt and collective responsibility for what has befallen the African population and what has befallen the Native American population. Now, recall that after Hitler was overthrown in 1945, the United States pressed this question of collective responsibility of the entire German nation. They did not accept the idea that fascism was the product of big business and that there was an anti-fascist movement that was quite significant. And, of course, they twisted the arm of Berlin until it paid reparations to Israel, which did not exist in 1945. And so as a result of the deteriorating relations between Berlin and Washington, punctuated by a meeting where purportedly the Oval Office actually threw something at Chancellor Merkel, expressing his disgust and revulsion at her. Of course, the fact that she's a woman is not irrelevant in this context. And so now it seems to me that the European Union might be seeking a kind of payback. And so the global correlation of forces is changing. The domestic correlation of forces is changing. And so therefore, yes, I would say that we can fathom the possibility of some kind of truth and reconciliation commission in the United States of America. However, we should never underestimate the strength and potency of the Trump base, which has yet to crumble and has yet to retreat.
Mm-hmm. What strikes you, Dr. Horn-Gerald, as different or distinctive? I know you've written about one of your early books was The Fire This Time, I believe I have the title correct, which is about the Watts riots. You've written extensively about domestic issues as well as there. What hits you as distinctive from 1965, 19 New York, Newark 1967, the Black Panther Party, the Chicago Convention, and this moment that we're looking at now?
Well, I think there's good news and bad news. I think that if you look at what, August 1965, for example, or Detroit, Newark 1967, or what happens from the Atlantic to the Pacific in the wake of the assassination of Martin Luther King in April 1968, one issue that will jump out with you is the question of organization. Of course, you in the San Francisco Bay Area know more than most about the Black Panther Party and how it had a significant ideological and political impact upon that generation. Of course, left its imprint on myself personally, I should also add. And that's different because today, the demonstrations, there is a kind of leaderless protest. There's not a centralized organization that you can point to. There's not an equivalent of the Congress of Racial Equality, which was then vibrant in the 1960s, or the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Dr. King's organization. And so this leaderless protest, this decentralization, to a certain extent, it relies upon spontaneity. To a certain extent, it becomes difficult to pinpoint even a spokesperson. Now, I understand that. That's a creative adaptation to the fact that centralized organizations like the Black Panther Party are bludgeoned into submission. Their leaders are assassinated, like Fred Hampton, December 4th, 1969 in Chicago, or jailed, like too many to mention. However, I think going forward, we're going to have to square that circle. We're going to have to try to find a happy medium between decentralization and centralization. On the other hand, I think the good news are this global outbreak of protests, now punctuated by this upcoming debate at the Human Rights Council of the United Nations. This is significant, as well as the rift between the erstwhile allies in Western Europe, particularly Germany, the spearhead of the European Union, and France, its comrade in arms. That's significant, as well as the fact that the hegemony of U.S. imperialism is now eroding with the rise of China. And that's different because, of course, in the 1960s, that was in some ways the heyday of U.S. imperialism, even though it was in the midst of being defeated in Vietnam. But still, it had enough wherewithal to help to bring the entire socialist camp to its knees, that is to say, in Eastern Europe, by 1989, 1991. So So there are many differences and similarities, but I think the bottom line is that it's possible to be cautiously optimistic as we speak.
Mm-hmm. There was a big demonstration, big protest, I think, in front of Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn yesterday. It was talking about Trans Lives Matter. And looking at the coalitions that were built by Fred Hampton, of course, the Rainbow Coalition, look at the coalitions that were made by the Black Panther Party, etc. What are the differences you see here in the structure of the coalitions from that period of time to now? Your thoughts, Gerald?
Well, it's interesting. I wrote this book about William Patterson, who was born in San Francisco, a black lawyer, filed the petition to the United Nations with regard to We Charge Genocide, a graduate of the University of California. And I recall writing about his relationship to the Black Panther Party and about his having meetings with Harry Bridges, a well-born in Melbourne, who spearheaded the San Francisco general strike amongst the longshore, helping to found the ILWU, still in existence. 1934 was the general strike. And they were consulting with the Black Panther Party, at least in the early stages.
Okay.
What I find striking, and what I think historians will find striking about what's going on today, is that in the protests in Washington, D.C., the headquarters of the AFL-CIO were defaced. Now, fortunately, the leadership of the AFL-CIO took the high road. They did not attack the protesters. But in some ways, that's symbolic, I think, of how we really need to have a significant reform within the trade union movement. I know you're familiar with my book on Southern Africa, and I talk
yes.
about the Portuguese Revolution of 1974 and how at a certain moment the CIA was about to throw in the towel. And this was transformative in terms of Southern African liberation, leading to the liberation of Angola, 75, Mozambique, 75, Zimbabwe, 1980, and ultimately the big enchilada, South Africa, 1994. But it's the AFL-CIO representative who shows up and lectures the CIA about having no backbone, and basically instructing the CIA to man up and get in there and try to destabilize this revolution. And so one of the differences today is that even in the 1960s, the labor movement wasn't all that it could have been. But I think in some ways it was stronger ideologically at certain levels than it is today. And until we can get the labor movement on track to play the role that it should be playing, we're going to have an uphill climb in these United States of America.
Okay. We're speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, the John Jay and Rebecca Moore Chair of History American Studies at the University of Houston. We've spoken with him on many occasions before here on Africa Today. And we want to talk a bit about his book, and then we want to go to some discussions about internationalism, specifically in regards to Africa and other African populations, black populations. Gerald, you have two books. One is in 2018 and one is in 2020. And both of them have apocalypse in the title. What are you trying to tell us?
Well,
am I not supposed to ask that?
No, I think it's long past time to recognize that the invasion of North America, initially by the Spaniards, and then secondly by the English, and of course, we're speaking their language, as is obvious, was a catastrophe, a debacle, a fiasco, yes, an apocalypse. For the indigenous population of North America, whose numbers plummeted spectacularly, and was also a disaster and an apocalypse for Africa. In the book that just came out a few days ago, The Dawning of the Apocalypse, I actually pinpoint the beginning of the precipitous decline of Africa to 1591, when the English, who are Protestants, and if I talk a little bit longer, you'll see that this religious affiliation is not irrelevant, collaborate with the Muslims in Morocco to destabilize the Songhai Empire in Central West Africa, a very important political formation. And with that, you see knock-on effects negatively ricocheting and cascading throughout the continent as far south as Nigeria, softening up that part of Africa for the onrushing African slave trade, which helps to build untold wealth in London and in Western Europe generally, and devastates Africa, which, of course, was the theme of the book by Walter Rodney of Guyana, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. And just the other day, we marked the 40th anniversary of his unfortunate assassination in Guyana in 1980. So I think it's well past time for the left in the United States to stop speaking and to stop looking at what happened in North America through these rose-tinted glasses, speaking fondly and warmly about the so-called incomplete bourgeois democratic revolution that led to a slaveholders' republic, which is a contradiction in and of itself, which led to genocide against Native Americans, enhanced genocide, I should say, because when the settlers took over, the situation actually worsened, and it led to the Yankees ousting the British from captaining the African slave trade. But as early as the 1790s, the Yankees had ousted the Spanish in terms of controlling the slave trade to Cuba. By the 1840s, as I said in my book, The Deepest South, the United States had ousted the Portuguese in terms of captaining the slave trade to Brazil, which is the mega market of all in terms of the African slave trade. So yes, this was an apocalypse. And until we stop rationalizing genocide and stop rationalizing mass enslavement and trying to find supposedly the silver lining in those dark clouds in terms of the alleged democratic rights that emerged, which of course did not apply to the Native Americans, did not apply to the Africans, it's like celebrating apartheid. I mean, apartheid had democratic rights for the European minority. It just didn't have it for the majority. And so it's in terms of fathoming something, how can you fathom denouncing apartheid on the one hand and then seeing something positive in terms of analogous events in North America? No wonder we are stuck with an oath in the Oval Office and have no guarantee that he'll be ousted on the first Tuesday in November.
Mm-hmm. You know, Gerald, in the book, you mentioned a couple of layers there, which I wanted you to walk through, and then another term, because you spend a good amount of time talking about the Iberian Peninsula and the competition among England, Portugal, and Spain. But you also bring into that particular discussion the rise of the Ottoman Empire and the challenges to Salah ad-Din, etc. Why is that a piece that you carry through some of the texts here, your new book?
Well, the Ottomans were a major power at that time, and were a major power up until about 100 years ago when they were defeated during World War I. That is to say that in many ways, this story I tell in this book, The Dawning of the Apocalypse, begins in 1453 when the Muslims take over what is now Istanbul, which sends nervousness and apprehension coursing throughout Europe. In fact, I suggest that when the Iberians, that is to say the Spanish and the Portuguese, begin to move west, that is because not only, as is traditionally said, that the trade routes to the riches of Asia eastward are blocked, the riches of Persia, India, and China, but also they were scurrying westward to get away from the Ottomans, who they felt were steadily moving westward, which of course they were steadily moving westward. And that's how they stumbled upon the Americas. Now, the issue is that, as you know, in 1517, Martin Luther breaks away from the Catholic Church. Whatever incentive London had to go along with the first mover's advantage that Catholic Spain and Catholic Portugal had in terms of encountering the Americas was removed. And therefore, you begin to see London move towards the Protestant faith. Of course, it's usually told in terms of Henry VIII wanting a divorce, and, you know, I don't argue with that. But I think that there are deeper material forces. And what you begin to see is that London begins to then collaborate with the Ottomans against the Catholics. The Protestants and the Muslims are collaborating against the Catholics. And that helps to catapult London into the passing lane. It's one of the reasons why we're speaking English today, because I think the Ottomans underestimated the English speakers. And I draw an analogy in the book with regard to the rise of China, because to the extent that China is in the passing lane as we speak, it goes back to the early 1970s with Nixon and Kissinger seeking to encircle the Soviet Union by cutting this deal with Mao's China, letting massive foreign direct investment from U.S. corporations to pour into China, building this juggernaut that now is in the passing lane. And now you see this showdown between Beijing and Washington as a result of that fateful decision, which the bourgeois commentators still see as a stroke of genius on the part of Kissinger. I guess they haven't thought that one through.
You know, Gerald, I'm going one way, then I'm going to bounce back to something we talked about earlier in January. I'm interested because you frame a couple of things. You frame this concept of whiteness, which at some point delve into that for us. But you also move the bar a bit in terms of kind of more than mainstream history when you begin to talk about the role of Asia in this period and the relationships and the tensions between the Iberian Peninsula and Africa and the role of Asia. Go off on that for a moment, please.
Well, first of all, keep in mind that the Spanish had a qualification to be a settler. You had to be Catholic. There was a religious test. In fact, you could be a Negro conquistador, as there were in the Americas, that is, say, a conqueror, as long as you profess Catholicism. That's the roots, indeed, of this substantial free Negro population in Cuba, which the roots of and the branches of which we still see in Cuba in 2020. Whereas the Protestant English, they did not have a religious text. First of all, there probably weren't enough Protestants to make for a sound religious text. They brought the base for settler colonialism by having a pan-European project. This allowed them to co-opt those they were battling, particularly the Irish Catholics, who, of course, become early settlers in North America. In fact, as you know, it's no accident, as the historians like to say, that Maryland, which is settled by the Europeans in the mid-17th century, it's settled by Catholics, in fact. Now, the Spanish would not tolerate letting Protestants be their settlers, just like when Moses Austin and Stephen Austin were authorized to move into what is now Texas
right.
In the 1820, they had to take a religious test. They had to profess to be Catholic. Now, I think there is doubtful if they were, but they had to profess to be. So the English do not have this religious test. They move to a pan-European test. They even incorporate the Jewish population. Now, London had expelled the Jewish population in 1291, but by the 1500s, they were under the gun, and so they incorporate the Jewish population into this tapestry of whiteness. Likewise, with regard to slavery, the Ottoman Turks were equal opportunity enslavers. They enslaved Africans. They enslaved Europeans. Look at the legacy of slavery in Albania and Bosnia, for example. Look at the fear and loathing they generated in Europe, as particularly as they were knocking on the doors of Vienna in 1683. The Spanish enslaved Filipinos. Recall that it was in the 1500s that the Spanish conquered this archipelago that they named after King Philip, the Philippines, and for the longest period, say from the 1500s, the time of the conquest, up until the late 17th century, the Spanish were dragging across the Atlantic people they called Filipinos to be slaves in Mexico. And so, in some ways, it was the people whose language we're now speaking, the English, who focused tightly on Africans as being the target for enslavement. In fact, I start that book on the 16th century with a quotation from Reverend Andrew Young, the former mayor of Atlanta, the former aide to Martin Luther King, who in the midst of negotiations with London over the fate of what becomes Zimbabwe, he charges that it was the English who, quote, invented, unquote, racism. And, of course, all hell breaks loose. He's pelted with a firestorm of invective, and he retreats. But there was something to what he had to say.
You know, I'm glad you brought up Andrew Young, because I'll leap over something and go to the discussion here about internationalism, about black people around the world, because Andrew Young got in a good deal of difficulty. He said something about that there were political prisoners in the United States, and then he had a meeting with someone apparently from the Palestine Liberation Organization. And so I'm interested in this theme of internationalism, Pan-Africanism, whatever you may refer to it as. Malcolm got in hot water with those discussions when he traveled to Africa. What does it mean that you see this solidarity, quote unquote, with what's happening in the United States across the black world? And at the same time, you see, why don't we deal with that piece first, and then we'll go to another piece. This solidarity in South Africa, there's this case, this gentleman named Collins Khosa, almost like a George Floyd case, in Kenya, et cetera. Jamaica, every place you go where there's black people, there's been solidarity with what's going on here in the States.
Well, I would not downplay or dismiss the staunch opposition and indeed revulsion towards the open the Oval Office, who after all dismissed an entire continent as being comprised of so-called S-hole countries. I think that that is a reason for these acts of solidarity in Africa, because not only is it sympathy with our cause, but it's a way to express their disgust with the 45th U.S. president. And then if you look historically, one of the points I've been trying to make in a number of these books I've been writing is that if you're the enslaved population in a settler colonial state, a settler colonial state that's founded and grounded on class collaboration between and amongst poor and richer Europeans, and then they have a successful revolt in 1776, establishing a slaveholders' republic, and then are able to propagandize so successfully that they can even convince the victims that this is a great leap forward for humanity, not to mention the rest of the world. Well, if you're going to make any progress as this enslaved population, you're going to need global solidarity, which then comes quite quickly with the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, which ignites a general crisis of the entire slave system that can only be resolved with its collapse, not least because the Haitians, like successful revolutionaries anywhere and everywhere, were seeking to spark and stoke a revolution similar to theirs, which leads to solidarity, first of all, in the Caribbean, but then washes over into North America. And then, of course, we know that with regard to the retreat of Jim Crow, it's not an accident that this begins to accelerate in the 1950s as African nations are coming to independence and Washington feels that it cannot compete for hearts and minds in Africa, which is replete with raw materials, not to mention the cheap labor that they lust for, that they cannot compete with the socialist camp for hearts and minds as long as people of color are being treated so atrociously here, which then creates momentum for desegregation, which in some ways in May 1963 reaches a parallel to what we're seeing today at the United Nations, when at the founding of the group then known as the Organization of African Unity in May 1963 in Addis Ababa, there are stern rebukes and reprimands of Washington for allowing black children to be mauled by police dogs in Birmingham, Alabama. And so I think that historically, the wisest amongst us, the more advanced forces, have recognized that because of the disadvantageous correlation of forces domestically, we've had to look overseas for solidarity. And the current moment is helping to solidify that perception.
Mm-hmm. Gerald, I was talking last week with someone talking about Brazil and Colombia, and of course the thoughts are of the last couple of weeks that Brazil is the epicenter of the COVID-19, that Colombia, and so whatever policy, whatever actions we're taking here, this administration, whoever that might be, has certainly not backed up on Bolsonaro in Brazil or Duque in Colombia, and has brought more and more pressure, including an attempted coup in a country like Venezuela has continued to ignore and, in fact, support what's going on to crush the movement in Haiti. Recently cut off Western Union to Cuba. So there's been no shortage of attacking African people, black people throughout the diaspora in the context of what we see now. Your thoughts on that, Gerald?
Well, certainly the situation in Brazil is quite concerning. It seems that the Trump of the tropics, as Bolsonaro likes to style himself, may be inviting a kind of self-coup. I mean, he's in many ways inviting the military to oust the regime he's now heading, which is quite curious indeed. But I think it represents the crisis in which he has plunged the nation, not only in terms of COVID-19 and how it is devastating this largest country by territory in South America, which borders on every other South American nation and also has the largest population of African descent outside of Nigeria. But it's also a representation and a reflection of the economic crisis, which he helped to generate by running a campaign in light of the improper ouster of his predecessor, Dilma Rousseff, of the Workers' Party, running a campaign basically taunting China as if he were actually the Trump of the tropics, when the Brazilian economy was heavily dependent upon exports to China. Indeed, with the trade war between China and the United States, you still have Brazilian soybean farmers and agriculturalists able to steal a share of that market from U.S. agriculturalists and soybean producers, which I think Mr. Trump will pay a heavy price for, despite the fact that he's sending billions in what are euphemistically called subsidies. If they were to us, they'd be called welfare, to these agriculturalists. But it's not just Mr. Bolsonaro and his harebrained schemes that are driving Brazil into the dust. It's also his successful effort to oust Cuban doctors, who would have been very useful in terms of addressing this pandemic. And of course, they're proving themselves to be quite useful in neighboring Peru and Italy, not to mention Haiti and countries too numerous to mention. And so the situation in Brazil is very concerning. Certainly, they need our solidarity. And I hope and I trust that as the African Union turns its attention to what they call systemic racism, unquote, and quote unquote, in the United States, that they will not neglect our brothers and sisters who are languishing under the misrule of this so-called Trump of the tropics.
And in Cuba, because the measures against Cuba have basically, the latest set of measures have attempted basically just to cut any remittances that come to Cuba.
Well, yes. And, of course, the United States is trying to drive tourism away from Cuba because, of course, Cuba has been able to handle the pandemic in a way much more competent than its gigantic northern neighbor, to the extent, as already noted, that it is exporting doctors, not least to Africa, which has led to a movement afoot to make sure, or to try to make sure, that Cuban doctors are awarded some kind of Nobel Peace Prize for their efforts with regard to fighting this pandemic, which certainly is not only threatening the global economy, but to a certain degree is threatening international peace and security as well. But those of us who are familiar with the star-crossed history between Cuba and the United States are not necessarily surprised by this turn of events. I mean, just a footnote. In a few days, we'll be marking Juneteenth. That is to say, the date when supposedly the Africans in Galveston find that they're free. Actually, the larger story is about how the Texans, that is to say, the Euro-Texans, were collaborating with the French, who had taken over Mexico, who thought that they could then invite the Texas to rejoin Mexico, which it had seceded from in 1836 because Mexico had moved towards abolition. But I bring up the story because Sam Houston, for which this city in which I now find myself, Houston, Texas, has been named, He gets a lot of props in this part of Texas for supposedly being against the Confederacy. But they don't go to the second point, which is that he thought that North and South should unite and take over Cuba, take over Mexico, take over the entire America, you see. Okay. And it's that demented dream that is yet to be extinguished.
You know, Gerald, as we're watching Dr. Gerald Horn from the University of Houston, who's joined us, his newest book, which is just, as he says, dropped today, The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. I was pointing out that over the last 2 years, he's had two books which have had apocalypse, so we'll be waiting for your third book with apocalypse in the title, Dr. Horn. This issue of what has been part of, I mean, a number of different things come out. Defund the police and reallocation of resources, and this comes from all the way going back to Oscar Grant up until the contemporary period. Been a lot of building and a lot of work. One issue which seems to need to have more wings, my assessment, perhaps incorrect, is the issue of incarceration. And I think that some of the, what is it, 9 out of the top 13 hotspots for COVID are in the prisons and jails. Your thoughts on that movement, because there were people who are advocating, hey, people, elderly people, release them, because if COVID is coming into the prison, it's being brought into the prisons by the people who work there. Your thoughts on this issue, Gerald?
Well, that issue of dealing with incarceration, I'm happy to say, is slowly gaining momentum, driven in no small measure by the fact that prisons are basically a petri dish for the circulation of the coronavirus. But I also think that it would be appropriate to see how this is linked to defund the police. Because if one iteration of this idea of defunding the police is that the police have too many duties. For example, they have duties that could just as well be handled by a social worker or a clerk, writing up accident reports after an automobile crash, or dealing with a mentally challenged, or responding to noise complaints from a nosy neighbor. You don't need a man or a woman with a gun to handle those kinds of situations. And when you send a man or a woman with a gun into those mundane situations, oftentimes it ends up either with a black person killed, such as we've been witnessing at infinitum in North America, or handcuffed and taken to prison, voila, incarceration. So certainly I think that we should see these issues as linked, and I think that the trifecta becomes, when you move from incarceration to defund the police, the trifecta is then defunding the military. Because when you talk about defunding the military, you're talking about making sure so-called surplus Pentagon materiel, be it grenade launchers or armored personnel carriers, are not sent to urban police departments where they treat civilians in the streets like they're enemy combatants, which oftentimes either end up with people being dead or incarcerated. And likewise, it eases pressure on our comrades abroad who are facing these armored personnel carriers and bazookas and grenade launchers, and allows for more enhanced solidarity between and amongst us. And I think that's one of the reasons why the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who participated in that photo op when the open the Oval Office left his bunker to cross the street and hold up a Bible upside down, and the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was in battle fatigue, as if he was ready to rumble, but he apologized. And I think he apologized for a number of reasons, because he knows his Pentagon is next, from defund the police to defund the military. And he also knows that there are many people, particularly black men and women in his ranks, who are uncomfortable, shall we say, with confronting their brothers and sisters and cousins in the streets on behalf of the oath in the Oval Office. And he can run the risk of splitting the military by getting them involved in a domestic dispute. So once again, there is reason for optimism as we confront these knotty problems that we are now encountering.
I want to encourage people also that in the series of texts that you've written recently, there is another text which is about the country of Haiti. You did something on Haiti. You also did something on Cuba. What was the title of the book on Haiti, The Haitian Revolution, Gerald?
Confronting Black Jacobins, United States, the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic.
And the other book, which I think is interesting, we won't have the time to talk about it today, basically in terms of culture, culture, politics that you see as part of the rebellions, the resistance in this period of time, and art and music and dance and whatever it may be. And that is your book. What is the title of the book on jazz, Dr. Horn?
Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music. One of the vignettes of that book that I think of, that I think fits into this conversation we're now having, is that I'm sure you recall Charlie Hayden and the Liberation Orchestra,
right,
played with Ed Coleman, the great late saxophonist. And just before the Portuguese Revolution erupts, they're playing a gig in Portugal, and they break into that iconic cut, which is one of my favorites, Song for Che. And, of course, the authorities recognize, even though it's an instrumental for the most part, the authorities recognize what's going down, and they're detained, and they're almost in prison. And fortunately, that does not happen, and they live to tell the tale. But that also represents a kind of militancy that ever has been a part of this music that we call jazz. Is represented in some of the cuts by John Coltrane and, for example, Alabama,
yes,
for example. It's represented in some of the cuts by, say, Pharoah Sanders, Coltrane's comrade, Got to Have Freedom. I could go on and on in this vein, and I think that I wholly and fully expect for our musicians and our artists to step up with regard to this moment. And actually, you see that. I'm sure you saw the letter spearheaded by the actor Viola Davis reprimanding and rebuking those in the theatrical community who have helped to foist the kind of white supremacist narrative on us in terms of drama and theater. We see you, this letter said. It's a quite remarkable document.
Okay. Dr. Gerald Horn, the John J. and Rebecca Moore Chair of History and American Studies, University of Houston. Take a look at it, The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. Gerald, as always, a pleasure, and you're always welcome on Africa Day, my brother.
Thank you for inviting me.
Take care.
I couldn't help but be very impressed at the outstart when the Freedom Singers were singing the song Oginga Odinga.